I've spent most of lockdown in glorious idleness. Not so Adam Hills, my guest today. We began by talking about the prep for this Friday's last leg.
Hello.
How are you, sweet?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah. Are you mid-show prep?
Early show prep. We don't do too much on a Tuesday. We learnt early on that the jokes that are and the topics that are current on a Tuesday aren't current on a Friday.
That the last time I remember being on was Dominic Cummings' week.
It was
Bernard Castle, and it just felt like, oh God, this is like the biggest open goal, and yet sometimes that's the hardest, isn't it?
Absolutely, it depends. Especially if it happens, like you say, on Wednesday, for instance, because by Friday, everyone on Twitter has made every joke there is to make about it. But it's still a big enough story that they're expecting us to talk about it. So then the question is, well, what do you say that hasn't already been said?
You always smash it.
Well, the best stories for us are the ones that break on a Thursday. People watch them, or actually the best stories are the ones that break on a Friday because they don't expect us to be that clever about it 2 hours later.
So anything's possible, isn't there? I suppose it's. Although with Brexit, one feels that there's a sort of, I don't know, a sad surety to the fucking dreadfulness of it all. It seems like we're just sort of slowly capitulating to a no deal and our complete and utter isolation from the rest of the world.
Well, that's the thing. We're going to literally leave the EU officially halfway through our New Year's Eve show. And we can't mention it because we'll be recording it 3 weeks prior.
Of course.
So I don't know what we're going to
do. No, I suppose you mark the moment. But then, you know, I suppose for some people that moment will be very, very joyful and lots of others, including now our farming community, less so, yeah.
Yeah. And we it kind of feels like we marked the moment in whenever it was, January, when we kind of left the first time. So,
yeah.
Yeah, our show's at its best when stuff happens last minute and we have to adapt.
And obviously, you know, Australia's close to everybody's heart, but Australia seems to have special prominence because it's Australia rules that we're obviously we're leaving under. Yeah. So do you know any more about that?
Well,
Australian trading terms with the EU.
I did kind of tweet, anyone that's ever tried to get some, you know, Iberica ham or maybe some German sausage in an Australian supermarket will know that we don't have a deal with
you. Yeah, I imagine that the sort of oak-aged parmesan is in short supply.
There's a reason that most Australian products are products that you've never heard of because they're made in Australia, because we can't import stuff from Europe.
But it's sort of now that's become the the word Australia has become the sort of euphemism of the time.
I have heard a rumor, and it's yet to be confirmed, but that it's a racist thing. They don't want to say, you know, we're going to be on the same deal as Afghanistan because that just sounds terrible. Yeah. But even the idea of an Australian points based system for immigration.
I mean, it's true, you've got that as well. They really are looking to you guys for all the wins.
Well, yeah, and it's a kind of a. You know, it appeals to the hard right wingers because they subconsciously go, oh, Australia, yes, they're racist, aren't they? They don't let anyone in. That's what we want.
So how does the points-based system work in Australia? I mean, I've seen a lot of the Border Patrol, by the way. I've seen a lot of that. And I base most of what I never had the joy of going to the Antipodes, but I base most of my feelings about it on the sniffer dogs continually patrolling Sydney airports. So the points-based system, presumably, as Priti Patel certainly sees it, is only the finest of the fine are allowed into our shores. Is that how it works?
Yeah, but it's a system that's open to be abused or manipulated in that, yes, only the finest of the fine can come in and you have to pass a medical test and you have to have a certain, you know, educational standard or professional skills that we need in the country. All of that stuff is one way of looking at it, but it's very easy to be manipulated. I mean, the history of that in Australia is that in the early 1900s, you couldn't, you had to be proficient. You had to have a language test before you came into the country to prove that you could make your way in Australia. But the authorities could issue that test in whatever language they chose. So it's well documented in the early 1900s that a lot of Maltese people came to Australia as citizens of the British Empire, as it was at the time, speaking good English, but were turned away because the authorities didn't want Maltese people in Australia, so they administered the test in German.
How on earth can you establish good practice for immigration by getting them to master a language that isn't spoken in the country of destination? I don't understand.
Because there was
You're right, it's just racism.
Yeah, it was racism. There was some loophole in the law that said, you know, you have to be proficient in European language of some sort.
They just didn't pick the one that they were proficient in.
Absolutely.
God. It now makes me, my mind tracks back to possibly thinking about who do you think you are, and you are partly Maltese. Is this
yes, that's right.
So take me through this. Who's the dude that's Maltese in your family?
On my mother's side, so when I did Who Do You Think You Are, we followed both of my mother's grandparents.
Yeah.
Yes. One came to Australia from, what was the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It is now in Bohemia. So I'm
nice,
part Bohemian. And then the other was my grandmother on my mother's side, her father came to Australia from, and her mother actually, from Malta. And, you know, in the refugees, in the kind of like 1910s, 1911. So that's when that's how I found out about, you know, this discrimination system for immigration. But then we followed it back. And I think originally when they made Who Do You Think You Are, they went, oh, that's a good story. One from Germany, one from Malta. That's a lovely kind of the melting pot that is Australia.
Yeah.
And then they went back somewhat. One of the historians in Malta said, oh, that surname, which was Vassallo, that could mean you were a slave, like a vassal. You were someone's slave. Or it could mean, it also goes to nobility. It could go either way. It might be worth looking into that. And so they went back and went back and went back and went back. And they ended up going further back than they had for any other Australian episode of Who Do You Think You Are, to the 1400s, I think, or maybe 1100s.
Bloody hell, that's a long way back for an Australian Who Do You Think You Are.
Yes, it was. It went back to my 11 times great-grandfather, who was, it turns out, one of the richest men in Malta, because at the time he owned shares in two pirate ships.
you're the offspring of the real Jack Sparrow. So the 11th generation of great-grandparent back...
Yes.
Piratical so-and-so. Or was he a pirate, or did he just own pirate ships?
No, he was very clever. He didn't do the dirty work. He got other people to do the dirty work for
him. I'm not a pirate. I just own some pirate ships. It's like the Jaffa Cake conundrum. He's managed to get out of it. Oh, I don't do the pirating. Provide the vessel. Oof, for the
someone
pirating.
Else does that. But the joke I missed at the time, and it was only... So we did the thing for Who Do You Think You Are, where they talk to you and it's explained piracy and... I was like, wow, that's amazing. And it was only in the car on the way back to the hotel that I went, oh my God. Oh my God. And the producers looked at me and went, yes. And I went, oh my God, I've just realized. And they were like, they said yes as if they were waiting for me to realize something. And I went,
yeah,
that's why I've got one foot. And I expected them to laugh, and they went, we've been waiting for you to make that joke for 2 hours.
Bloody good joke.
That's the camera.
So annoying. So the camera was rolling then, or is it gone?
No, the camera wasn't rolling. So.
Oh God, I hate that. The proper L'Esprit d'Escalier thing, where you're just on the way home and it's like, when you're on the night bus, I think, as John Higley puts it in a poem, and you think, God, that would have been amazing.
So I ended up doing the joke, though, in one of the post wrap-ups where they say, what have you learnt? And then I did the joke. So it managed to make it to air. But the amazing thing is they admitted to me afterwards that they were 90% sure, but unless they're 100%, they won't put it as part of the episode. They were 90% sure that my lineage could be traced back to the Emperor Charlemagne. But there was like a 100-year gap where I think Charlemagne sent one of his daughters to the south of Italy.
Yeah, this is already quite vague from them, I think.
So, and she married someone by the name of Vassallo. So it was the right surname.
So there's the connection.
That was the connection. And then my Vassallos came from the south of Italy around about maybe 100 or so years later. And they kind of went, look, and there are people of the same lineage that say, oh yeah, we go back to Charlemagne. and they just couldn't prove that, like, they won't put it to air unless they've got the paper trail that absolutely proves it. And they said, look, they said for months we had a picture of Charlemagne up in the office next to a picture of you, both in profile. You've both got the same shaped nose. We were like, this is amazing. And they said, if we had more time and more researchers, maybe we could establish the connection. But we're pretty sure you're related to Charlemagne, but we just can't quite make that final picture.
You've got to take that, though. Come on. Yeah. The thing is, we're not experts, so we don't need to, you know, be sort of held to the burden of proof. We can just make any old shit up. As far as I'm concerned, you are Charlemagne.
Thanks. So, we've got the same nose.
I know. I love the fact that it's like, no. We need to prove 100% to put it out on the programme, but at the same time, we're convinced just from the profile of your nose. You can't have it both ways. I did. My cousin did a bit of delving into our genealogy, and she went back about as far as 1680. I've never seen a more drab, homogenous. Sort of, you know, it was just all the women char ladies, all the men either blown up as sort of, you know, early grade cannon fodder, sort of mints, basically mobile mints, just sent out. Or if they weren't detonated, then they were labourers. And that was to 1680. It was just, nope, you've got one job, you stick to it. It's handed down. So I think I've got a vague memory that sort of series two or three of Who Do You Think? They said, are you interested? And I was super excited because I want to cry over manuscripts. This is a thing. I always want to sob over those library books. And they did. They said, well, before we book anybody, we're driven by the research, and we're just going to go off and find out. Never heard from them again. They obviously made this. Yeah, too dull.
Oh no!
if it helps, Charlemagne.
From what I understand, you're in the same company as Michael Parkinson.
Really?
I think they looked into his family, and I mean, the idea of Who Do You Think You Are with Michael Parkinson could have been amazing. And they looked into it and went, everyone was a miner from this northern town where he grew up, and there was nothing else there.
But still, at least he's broadened his attitudes with age. That's the thing. That's the great thing about age, is that you can change. You can really evolve and grow. God almighty.
Yeah, that's not funny.
No. No, I know, because genetically, it's impossible for me to be so.
Do you know what I struggle with? I mean, so many things. the idea of saying anyone isn't funny, whether you're saying women aren't funny or Michael McIntyre isn't funny, or that guy that you kids watch that I don't get into isn't. I mean, we know humor is subjective. And it's fine for someone to say, I don't think that person's funny, or I don't think this style of comedy is funny. It doesn't appeal to me. But it just always amazes me that anyone could just have a declaration of, that's not funny, or these type of people aren't funny. Well, no, they're not funny to you. And if they're not funny,
he's never seen any, though. He won't have ever gone. I mean, when's the last time Parky went to a club and saw, you know, and saw? I mean, he'll have never seen stand up, I imagine. I mean, they might be doing him wrong, but he won't have watched what we've watched growing up, you know, 20, 30 years of the comedy scene changing. And some might say with good reason, not changed enough, but certainly it has changed.
And not just stand up, like in your everyday life, have you never, like, do you not find any women funny? Like,
oh god, yeah. But then you look at his Helen Mirren interview and you think, well, he's never given anyone the chance to be funny. He's just straight in there with the, oh, don't you look lovely with your lovely look-up dress there. That's lovely. What do you want, an Oscar or a lovely? Good for you, girl. It's awful.
And I have to be nice about Parky, because I did once interview him for an Australian TV show and he was absolutely lovely. And I admitted to him, I opened the interview by saying, I'm really sorry, I'm a bit tired. I didn't sleep very well last night. And I said, only 5 minutes ago did I realise why I didn't sleep very well. It's because I was nervous about interviewing you.
Yeah.
And he beautifully just said, you should never be nervous about interviewing an interviewer, because we know what you're looking for out of an interview, because it's what we look for constantly. So we'll do our best to give it to you.
And so did he surprise? Did he offer stuff? Because I sort of think if I'm being interviewed, I always want to try and give them something I've never said before. Even if it's minor, just so it's not a sausage factory. So did he give you something that you do know what I mean, that was exciting to you, or something that you didn't feel was out of his sort of wiki entry?
Yes, he did from memory. And I think because he doesn't get interviewed very often, so it was, I think it was a chance for him to actually talk a bit about his life and his, what I did for that particular interview was I got viewers to tweet in questions. So I was asking him things that wouldn't normally be asked in an interview, like things about his cricket, like growing up playing cricket. And I think he said that he wanted to play, his dream in life was to play for England. And that amazed me to think that, you know, this man who's as famous as he was as an interviewer was like, yeah, but I really wanted to, you know, win the Ashes. I found that, although I did an interview, I also around the same time, I did an interview with Jerry Hall. And right. I thought, again, I'll get viewers to tweet in questions. And I chose ones that I knew would lead into, I thought I was being incredibly clever. And I chose questions that would lead into an answer that I knew would take me to a place that I thought was fascinating about her life. And so I should have explained this better to her, to be honest. But the first question was, do you prefer tomatoes in a salad or not? And the reason I asked that was because I knew she grew up on a tomato farm.
Okay.
It was a genuine question. It was a genuine question from a viewer, and I thought, I'm going to ask that, and then I'm going to lead into the tomato farm and what was life like and blah, blah, blah. But I didn't really explain that well enough, so I kind of went, so the first question is, do you prefer tomatoes in a salad? And she looked at me like, who has sent the work experience kid to this stupid interview? And then gradually I kind of won her over, but this is the single worst interview of my life, and it is entirely my fault. She was starring in The Graduate, I think it was, the play.
Yes.
And I'd read in an interview where she had said that acting is better than sex, and you get to do it six times a week and twice on a Saturday.
Okay.
I thought, great, I will lead her into that. And I said, yeah. So you have said, and then thinking she would say that answer, and then I would say, well, in my case, having done a bit of acting, unfortunately, my reviews are the same as my sex life. Not very believable, slightly wooden.
Slightly wooden, not a bad review, though. But slightly wooden. Very wooden would be an excellent review.
So I thought this would be the lovely joke. So I said to her, yeah. You have said that, you know, acting is better than sex. Is that correct? Expecting her answer of, you know, that she had given. And she kind of smiled at me and raised an eyebrow and went, well, depends who the sex is with. Which completely threw me.
Was it slightly come on-y? Did you feel like slightly she was just a little tilting her gaze towards you?
No, I wouldn't read that much into it. I think she was tilting her gaze towards someone else. It certainly wasn't me. She was referring to someone that she's had amazing sex with. But I was thrown. And instead of, and I said, well, yeah, and, you know, the reviews are the same, not very believable, slightly wooden, which she thought I meant was a reference to her reviews, not my reviews.
Oh, okay.
And she hadn't received fantastic reviews for some of her acting. And she was lovely throughout the rest of the interview. She smiled and everything was fine. And then the next day, my producer went, I should let you know, we've had a complaint from her agent about you saying her acting is not believable and slightly wooden. And I went, oh my God, that was about me. I was referring to me.
Oh, no.
I was making a joke. And then I went, oh, I didn't say, I was so thrown that I didn't deliver the joke properly. And I made it look like I was making a joke. So fair play to her for being that professional that she didn't like show any offense or anything like that. But I sent an email through afterwards, but it is the single lowest moment of any interview that I've ever done.
But she will also, but even with that misunderstanding, there will be a joy there that you actually bothered to engage with her work, read some stuff about her. You know, I don't know about you, but sometimes you get mainly influencers or something that will, and you will go in and they will talk to you as if you've just been delivered from Amazon and they've opened the box and they're a bit disappointed. And then they fire off one of those sorts of pro forma sort of template emails, which says it's too big, too small, doesn't fit, whatever. Yes. And they're just going through that going, so when did you start filming? When have you finished? When's it out?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's great. It's really lovely. It's like, next one, next. And maybe that's my own huge, grandiose ego, but it's just like the first principle of wanting to be in that job has got to be curiosity.
Yes.
Otherwise, what's the point?
And what, so on that, I did an interview in Montreal a few years back with Chevy Chase.
Oh,
and I was called.
Tell me he was nice.
Well, here's the thing. So I was called in last minute because the person who was meant to interview him wasn't available. Could you interview Chevy Chase? And I was like, yeah, I'd love to. I'm a huge fan. But he has a reputation for being incredibly difficult.
Oh, okay.
Incredibly difficult. To the point where all the people around me were like, oh, good luck. Like, no one was like, hey, you're going to interview Chevy Chase. I was like, yeah. Oh. I think thankfully for me, weirdly, he'd had a terrible gig the night before. He'd presented one of the galas and it hadn't gone particularly well. And so he was...
A bad gala is, yeah.
Oof. Yeah, he was humble. He wasn't like flying on top of the world. And I asked him how it went and he didn't say it went terribly, but to his credit, he said, look, I don't perform to a live audience. He said, even when we did Saturday Night Live, that was the biggest audience I ever performed to. And that was 300 people in the room and I wasn't talking directly to them. And he said, I don't think I really knew what I was in for last night. And it was a fine enough interview. And we got to the end and I said, look, I've got one more question. And this, to be honest, probably won't go to air, but this is really just for me. In Caddyshack, you putted a golf ball and made it jump over another golf ball into the hole. Was that a special effect? And he went, and his like whole face opened up. And he went, no, I actually did that. And I went, how?
Yeah,
how? And he went, oh, well, here's what you do. The ball that you're trying, the ball you're about to hit, you step on, and you push it down into the turf a little bit, so it's almost in a little bit of a hole. Then when you hit it, you hit down on the back of it, which pushes it down into the hole. It comes back up over, and then it goes over the ball. And I went, oh, that's amazing. Are you a golfer? And he went, no, well, yeah, I'm a tennis player. And I went, oh, I'm a tennis coach. I used to be a tennis coach. And then we had a discussion about a game of tennis that he had with, I think it was George Bush and Martina Navratilova and maybe John McEnroe or something. And it was like... Yeah. It was such a lesson to me of don't ask the obvious question. Ask the question that you genuinely want to know the answer to, because that's probably going to lead you somewhere interesting.
Now I'm obsessed with you being a tennis coach. Of course, you forget that everyone has multiple lives behind the obvious career. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. There's the jazz hands, and then behind that, there's this ball thwacking supremo in tight white shorts. When were you a tennis coach? This was back in Australia.
Back in Australia. So tennis was my sport. I played tennis from, I guess, the age of 6 to about 22 properly.
So you must have been super good, basically.
Was good. I was never going to go professional or anything like that. I was aware there were a few people that were coached in the same kind of clinics that I was coached in that did play.
You were coached in a clinic?
Yeah, so
that sounds like a very medical environment. I'm just a clinic, we will teach you tennis as long as you take your medication.
I think that's what they clinics or squads.
Really?
I think
it was not a school or a I don't know. Tennis, well,
there
was clinic. Like,
there were levels. So you do tennis classes, and if that went well, tennis lessons, and if that went well, then you'd move up to squad, and then if that went well, you'd move up to clinic.
Okay, so that's when you get into the real, you know, nitty gritty about technique and stuff.
Yeah, and those were the ones that were like being groomed to go professional. so I was never at that point, but I did coach from about the age of probably 17 to maybe 21. So I had 3 years of coaching.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by June's Journey. Now, you probably already know that June's Journey is a fabulous hidden object mobile game, which is free to download from iTunes or Google Play. The game follows amateur detective June Parker as she tries to solve the mystery of her sister's murder. Tiggy, be quiet, please. It's set during the roaring 20s and is perfect to escape into when you've got a spare 5 minutes and need a break from the stresses of work and family. I've been playing it loads over the last few weeks, and it's a great way to relax, but also test my observational skills, as each scene is a new challenge, finding hidden objects and discovering more about the murder of Claire and Harry. The hundreds of colourful scenes keep the game fresh and vibrant, while the lightly challenging puzzles help keep my brain active and engaged. I find it the perfect balance of relaxing and challenging. And if you enjoy puzzles, murder mystery, and great stories, this game is perfect for you. You can download June's Journey now for your phone or tablet, from either iTunes or Google Play, or by clicking the link in the description of this episode.
your first prosthetic?
Yes. So my first, I mean, I don't remember. My mum still got them.
She?
Yeah. She's got, there's a collection. So the first is just, so my right foot, if you were to put your hand into a like a fist,
yeah,
and basically go like that, that's kind of what my foot looks like. It's a little stump and you bend your wrist back. So I've got a heel. I can take weight on it.
Okay.
And I guess probably for the first few years of my life, the height difference between my left and right foot wasn't that pronounced. So really the first thing I had on my right foot was just a little leather boot, really, mm-hmm. that was almost made in the shape of the stump. And I guess I don't remember walking around in that. I've only seen it because my mum's kept
sure.
it. Then after that, the next thing was a shoe, which had like a brace, I guess you would call it, at the back. And my stump was
attached.
Yeah.
To your calf.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it would strap around the front of my calf. But that, I guess that was the only shoe I could wear for, you know, a good couple of years until I grew. And then another prosthetic was made that was slightly bigger that I could take in and out of other shoes. I mean, the one I've joked about it on stage, but the one thing that I was never able to do was wear flip-flops. They could never.
You bad Australian.
And literally they tried to come up with technology that would allow me to wear flip-flops. Because I think at about the age of maybe 12 or 13, the doctors, you know, in that kind of, is there anything the other kids can do that you wish you could do? And I went, yeah, I want to wear thongs, which is what we call them. So they then made a prosthetic with a gap in it where the toes are so that you could put the flip-flop in. But of course, I didn't realize when you walk with a flip-flop, you actually grip with your toes so that it doesn't fall off. So every time I walked, it would just fly off the front.
So you have to shuffle, presumably. You'd have to keep the foot fairly close to the floor.
So then, and that didn't work. So then my mum stuck a bit of Velcro to the bottom of my foot and to the top of the flip-flop to see if that would work. And it didn't, God bless her. Thankfully for me, sandals came back into fashion.
Yep. I love the fact that you were so keen to have it, but they tried. That's amazing, though, that they go, okay, we're going to make your life better by building a bit. It's like a built-in sort of open a forked toe that would facilitate a thong.
That's exactly what it was.
Imagine if you got in the next time going, no, I want to wear a stiletto, or I want to wear some langlaufing boots, or I want to, you know, you could have had a prosthetic for every different footwear occasion.
The one that I do have, so when I get my prosthetic made these days, I have to take in whatever shoe I currently own that has the highest heel on it.
Okay.
And they make the prosthetic according to that. And then if I'm wearing other shoes, then I have to chalk up the heel because I can't adjust my ankle for the heel. So it's easier if I do it on a flat surface and then I put on something with a heel, it throws my whole leg and hip forward and it doesn't quite. So yeah, if I did want to wear stilettos, my point is, they would make a prosthetic that would accommodate that.
And do you get sort of, if you don't jack up the heel to the right level, do you find that you get sort of associated sort of pain in your knees and your hips and stuff?
Constant hip and back. Not constant, but a lot of hip and back pain, especially as I get older, you know, the body doesn't adjust as well as it used to. So I'm finding that I need to do Pilates, I need to do stretches. The older I get, the more I need to do stuff.
Getting older is shit, isn't it? I mean, in one way, it's great because I don't know about you, but I care less about the things that don't matter mm-hmm. and I can constructively engage better with the things that are important.
Yeah.
But getting out of bed, the groaning, is, and it just goes on and on and on. And actually, it's only about, for me, at midday, I start to think, oh, yeah, that's it, everything's working. And then I sit and work and then everything seizes up again until I go to bed. It's just shit.
Do you remember the last time you woke up feeling good and refreshed? Because I genuinely don't.
Well, no, not really. No, not. I mean, and I don't know what my excuse is because I don't have kids, but I think I'm probably going back a good 10 years.
Yeah, at least. I literally remember one morning in Montreal during the comedy festival waking up thinking, oh, I feel good today. And that is, I think that's the last time 15 years ago that I woke up feeling good.
Maybe Montreal's your lucky charm. Maybe you should go there, something in the air or something. But it's just, it's the niggles. And, you know, thank God, you know, nothing else. But it's just, We're not old. We're not the ancients.
The last time I had a proper checkup with my doctor in Melbourne, she kind of said, you know, what exercise are you doing? And I said, look, I play golf. I play a little bit of tennis. I'm not really big for running. I'll go to the gym occasionally. And she said, good, no, they're the right things to do. And she said, look, she was about the same age as me. She said, at our age, exercise isn't about keeping fit. It's about not dying.
That's a GP I can get on board with. It's just death prevention. Oh, God. I mean, what do you do with that? You just go, yeah, all right. That's the kind of bald knowledge that I need to roll with now.
And then on the other side of that, so my grandfather is now 101.
What? He's alive. Your grandfather's alive. That's amazing.
Yeah, and he's only just moved into a care home in the last year and a half. He was living on his own even up until he was 100.
Is this your mum's dad or your dad's?
My dad's dad, actually.
So the non-Charlemagne branch.
The non-Charlemagne branch, the Hills branch. And I was talking to him like when he was, now bearing in mind, he would have been in his 80s at this point when he was saying, oh, I'm just bored. He lived on his own. My grandmother had just passed away and he said, I'm bored. I said, well, why don't you take up, there's a lawn bowls club like five doors down. Why don't you take up lawn bowls? And he went, oh God, I'm not that old. And I kind of went, well, I get what you're saying, but there are like 30 and 40 year olds. Like it's become quite trendy now to do lawn bowls in Australia. Yeah. And so there's like, there's 30 and 40 year olds playing lawn bowls. And he went, yeah, I know. But in my head, I'm still 18.
That's good to know that you can get to 100 and still, because inside I'm 17.
Right.
And I look at this crumpled edifice and think, what the hell happened? Because I'm still ready to go. But the body is like a nano behind. Yeah. I wonder if you're frozen at a time which was uniquely fun and perfect. Because at 17, everything was good.
Yeah. I think for me, it's probably maybe a tiny bit earlier, maybe 16, but still, you know, before leaving high school, maybe.
Yeah. Whole world's your oyster there.
Yeah. I think that's the thing.
I suppose British audiences are very used to seeing the cream of Australian comics coming over and making a living here.
Mm.
But I could not have done, I mean, we're so blasé about it. It's like, oh, great, look at this amazing town. I could not do what you guys did. I could not have, I don't know what time of your life you came to England, but I couldn't uproot and, you know, do the clubs, do Edinburgh, do the... So far away from everything that I knew. And I think people sort of underestimate how much chutzpah it takes to do that. How much balls it takes to do that.
I mean, there is a great old... You saying that makes me think of a great old saying by, I think it's Clive James. So if you ever go to Sydney and Sydney Harbour, around Circular Quay, which is where the Opera House and the Sydney Harbour Bridge is. So basically between the Sydney Harbour Bridge and the Opera House, there's a really lovely walk. And it's called Writer's Walk. And every now and then on the footpath, there'll be like you have blue plaques here, but it's a big circle on the footpath and it'll be in memory of a specific writer. I think Kenneth Slessor is one, probably Banjo Patterson. And there's one for Clive James. Mm. And the quote that goes along with his name, and I will probably get it slightly wrong, but it is along the lines of, it would be churlish to suggest that the power and beauty of Australia that gives us the strength to go and travel wouldn't eventually draw us back home again.
That's lovely.
And I think we come from such a safe, comfortable, protected and protecting environment that we feel safe enough to go and travel the world and see what else is out there. And knowing that at the end of the day, we can always go back.
It's interesting that the sort of psyche of Australia, at the risk of being pretentious, is sort of a very sort of nurturing one. Which I don't think, I think I could possibly lay claim to, but then I'm older. I wonder now if England would be so if younger people feel the same way about England. I think it would be actually that the turbulence around England and national identity is so great that it propels people to go. It's not that they feel cushioned enough to experience something. It's just they feel unnerved by it. They want to get away from it. But it's a hugely big deal. I'm always so impressed by anybody who has taken those steps. And that's why I simply don't understand people when they talk about immigration. It's like, hang on, these people have, you know, take for example, you know, the caravans coming from Venezuela or through to Mexico, yeah. they have already proved themselves as people of such grit and worth.
Yeah.
To do any job, to fulfill any position in your country. It's like, have you any idea what it takes to just cross these terrains, these deserts and these... It's just, it's unbelievable. And I would not be able to do it, I don't think. I just wouldn't... I don't have enough gumption, I suspect. But I'm always incredibly drawn and impressed by people that do.
Well, and then, you know, those are the people, that's why the statistics are that, you know, refugees and immigrants are more likely to set up their own business than anybody else, because they're self-starters. They've had to be. But, you know, the other side of that is, as I've mentioned, that we have exactly the same problems in Australia, the kind of anti-immigration stance and the mm-hmm. I wouldn't want refugees coming over. And yet so much of Australian life has been informed by more Maltese or Greek or Italian refugees or Vietnamese,
yeah.
And, you know, now it's more Somalian as well. You know, not to mention 200 years ago, convicts and you know, English people coming to Australia in the first place. So, I think you would find it in yourself, within yourself, to probably uproot and do something. I mean, you strike me as someone who's happy to take a bit of a risk.
Yeah, I guess so. But I think the scene, I mean, you left the scene in Australia for... You just wanted a wider... Did you want a wider canvas? Was that it? Or did you always have it in your head, okay, I want to be a comic, but to do that, I'm going to go to Europe and I'm going to go to London specifically?
It wasn't... I mean, it was always, I'm going to be a comic. I mean, once I found comedy, that was the thing that my whole being went, oh, this is it. Here we go.
Yeah.
I feel lucky that I found it early on, that it didn't take me years to find that thing that I felt that I really clicked with. But I always thought America was the goal. I always thought I would end up in the States. And it wasn't until, I mean, and I had a really good manager that taught me to just follow the work. You know, yeah. if someone's offering you a job somewhere and it's a job that you want to do, go there, just follow the work, go where the gigs are. But I ended up in radio in still tennis coaching. I'm trying to work out what year this was, 91, 92. Just submitted a whole bunch of jokes to a radio station breakfast comedy show. Didn't go for the number one because they didn't need jokes. Number two would always be looking for jokes. Actually, okay, full story. So a friend and I, Belinda Franks was her name, we were supporting Peter Powers, Britain's naughtiest hypnotist.
There will be supplementary questions about the naughtiest hypnotist. So we'll come back. Let's park that because okay. That is... world of beauty there. Okay.
And his season didn't go particularly well through no fault of his own. There was a dodgy promoter.
Was he too naughty?
Possibly not naughty enough. Okay. But it was a dodgy promoter. And Belinda and I sat up, you know, after the season was called off early, thinking, what do we do? Maybe we should send in some jokes to the local radio show, the breakfast show. So we literally sat up that night until 4 in the morning. We got the local papers when the newspapers came out. We looked through, we wrote about 20 or so jokes, faxed them off to the radio station, and went to our respective homes. And then the next day I got a call from the producer saying, did you see our advertisement? And I said, what is advertisement? He said, well, the advertisement for writers. And I went, oh, yeah, the advertisement, lying. And he said, everyone else sent in resumes. You guys sent in jokes. That's the kind of like proactive people we want.
That's great.
So I ended up working in radio and as a writer for this breakfast show in Sydney, and then was offered a job in Adelaide as on-air talent. So I went to Adelaide and did that for a few years, but it was never, you know, when you meet someone, say like Christian O'Connell, who was born to be on radio.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I grew up loving Kenny Everett. He had a head for connecting with an audience and sound effects and soundscapes that is just built for radio. I don't think I had that. I think I still loved stand-up all the way through. And in 1997, when I was in Adelaide, someone came up with the Adelaide Comedy Festival as opposed to the Adelaide Fringe Festival, which was every second year. And I saw all these English comedians come over, Stuart Lee, Richard Herring, Dave Johns, Boothby Graffo, and Boothby in particular, yeah. I really bonded with, and
he's great. Boothby Graffo,
I love Boothby, and he took me aside, and we really I connected with him, and at the end of that festival, he said, "You need to go to Edinburgh." And it had never been on my radar. And he said, "Go to Edinburgh." And I said, "Really?" And he said, and this was the way he put it. He said, "Even if you die on your ass every night for a month, you'll still be a better comedian at the end of it." And I thought, wow, that is a really, that's, I mean, I want to be a better comedian, and I'm going to do this. So I got myself to Edinburgh. There were people there that worked at the Gilded Balloon. And as soon as I saw the Edinburgh Festival, I went, there it is. There. So it wasn't a conscious, it wasn't like I'm aiming at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and I'm aiming at breaking the UK. It was that suggestion. And then I went and saw the Edinburgh Fringe and went, oh my God, yes, I want to do this every year.
Yeah, I'm the same about Edinburgh. It has such a, we did it every year for years on end, and it's still my spiritual home. There's nothing like it. There's nothing like the buzz of going onto the Royal Mile. And even if you're accosted by, you know, a sort of Georgian sort of sex worker leafleting you, you don't really care. You're just like, yes, of course you're doing a play about that. Brilliant.
Yeah.
All that creativity, it changes the bricks and mortar of the place. It really is amazing.
And so if that was enough to draw me from Australia, and it was enough to draw you from wherever you were, then
Croydon.
Were in Australia and you were aware of the Edinburgh Fringe, if you saw it for the first time, you'd go back.
True. And yeah, and you're right. And Boob is right in that it's the only place really where you get to try the same basic material, which you can reshape, of course, daily, but for 28 days on the trot. And it's extraordinary that.
It's like one of those advanced learning courses that you can do during the school holidays that bring you up to speed in maths, except that's in comedy. And and I remember the first time I went, or the second time I went, I then went back to the Sydney Comedy Store just to do a week's run, as you do. And I remember the manager of the Comedy Store saying, "Oh my God, what happened to you while you were away?" And I didn't feel any different. I felt like nothing. I'm just doing gigs. And she went, "Yeah, but there's something that's changed." And I think every time I went to Edinburgh, I came back and I was up. I'd gone up a little level without even realizing. Like, I didn't feel any different, but I noticed the audience were laughing a little bit more, and other people thought I'd got better. So, it was just that commitment to the craft. It wasn't like I desperately want to break the UK. It was, I'm going where the work is and where the creativity is.
And are you still like that, or does it feel more like, I don't know where do your family live back in Oz? I seem to think they do, but, or are they back in London with you now?
They moved back to Australia about a year ago. So I still have this ridiculous thing, which was summed up, because clearly we've done a lot of homeschooling this year. And one of my daughter's tasks was to identify something in your life, a change that you've gone through recently, and what's a positive and what's a negative from it. And the change that she wrote was, moving back to Australia from London. And what was the negative? I don't get to see my dad very often. And what was the positive? He gets to do what he loves.
Oh, God.
It broke my heart, but in a lovely way. That,
yeah.
Like, I know that she gets it, but, you know, I'm still doing it. I'm still over here. You know, every now and then I have those moments of, what am I doing? I should just go back home and be with my wife and kids and live in Australia. And then I think, and then something will hit me and I'll go, oh no, hang on. I've got a really good show on Channel 4 and a lot of people are watching it. And I think we're doing a really good thing. And this is kind of what I really would have wanted my career to be. So don't walk away from all of this.
That's horrible. That's the classic, you know, you get to live both lives that you want. Unfortunately, you have to live them simultaneously.
Yes. You know, yeah.
You have the family you crave. You have the, as you say, the ideal career. Yeah. My God, I don't know how you juggle that, especially when they are, I mean, it must be a real brain splitter because they're geographically split. It's not like if they're in London where you can go, okay, daddy's going off to show off now,
yeah.
But I'll be there to tuck you in. It's, yeah, that's, I mean, the seasons are long for Last Leg as well now, aren't they?
Well, and yes, I mean, you know, we talked to the girls about how this would work and said, look, you know, it would mean me being away for 10 weeks, but then I'll be home for 6 or 7 and then I had to go away for 8. And they said, yep, we're fine with it. And we literally pulled out a calendar and coloured in the weeks that I'd be away and the weeks that I'd been home so that they got an idea of it. Of course, COVID threw everything out the window in a good and a bad way. It meant I've just had six months at home with them nonstop, which I would never normally have. So the thing that keeps me going is that my dad, and this possibly ties into my willingness to do all this, my dad was a Qantas cabin crew member.
Was he?
So for the first 20 odd years of my life, he was away 2/3 of the time. He'd be gone for 20 days, he'd be back for 10. He'd be gone for 5, he'd be back for 2. So the idea of having a dad on the other side of the world, and the furthest he would go is London. He would do a London trip and he'd be gone for 3 weeks. And funnily enough, the last thing he said to me, like, he passed away a few years ago, and before he kind of got to the point where he couldn't talk, the last thing he said, and in a very determined way, was, "Good luck with everything in London." And he said it in such a determined way that I thought, that is, like, looking back, I'm like, I think he probably knew that was the last thing he was going to say to me. So I still have moments now when I'm doing the last leg, and I have that moment, like, in the seconds before we go to air, that I look down the camera and think, what am I doing? What am I doing on the other side of the world, away from my wife and kids, hosting a TV show about British politics? I shouldn't know about British politics. This is ridiculous. And I'll just get my dad's voice go, "Good luck with everything in London." And I'll think, okay, I'm meant to be here. For whatever reason, I'm meant to be here. This is the job I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I remember seeing you talk about your dad a bit on Stand Up To Cancer. I think it was it was a little VT, and I just totally lost it, because I think I lost my dad roughly the same time.
Right.
And yeah, one of his last words to me were, "You're good with people. Just keep doing that." And it just really just like, wow. It was quite a broad career advice, that, if I may say. I could have done with something a little bit more specific. Yours is geographically specific. Well, you're good with people. I mean, I could be anything. I mean, most jobs are forward facing, you know. I could be in most professions, you know. I could be in Greggs and be in good. I love a bit of Greggs. But it does, for me, that was quite a banal statement. But because it was one of the last things he said, it takes on this incredible sort of portentousness and momentousness, you know.
And I think, you know, I'd like to, I like to think that my dad knew somewhere deep down this might be it. You know, I think he thought at that point that he wasn't going to see me for a while. And so, yeah, this was probably the final goodbye. I mean, having said, and I'd love to think that I would impart a similar thing to my daughter, but I think I'd get caught up in the moment and I'd try too hard. And that's reminded me, Boothby Graffo again once told me, I don't know if it's his father or his grandfather, but it was certainly an elderly relative that was on his deathbed and the family had gathered round and knew that he was on his way out, and he knew he was on his way out. And so he clearly had decided what his last words were going to be, and kind of raised himself up from the bed and looked around at the room and surveyed them, and then delivered his final sentence that he had rehearsed, and then laid back down and didn't die straight away.
Awkward.
And then opened his eyes and looked around the room and went, "Oh, bugger." And then died. I think that's what I would do. That's what I would end up doing.
But then what a great comedy way to go. It's just not with a bang, but with a whimper. A very beloved friend of mine, the last thing her gorgeous dad, who was such a big, you know, where they always are, thing. And they'd gone round, he died very suddenly. They'd gone round to sing Christmas carols. And he was a real sort of harumph. He was like, "Oh, God." And they were singing carols into his face in this old people's home. The last thing he said to them was, "Go, please go away." So I always sort of, oh, you know, my dad, you know, he was such a, you know, he gave me so much. And in those final days when I got to nurse him, you know, we really showed, no, I got go. This is the legacy now that I have. But isn't it amazing though that you have that, albeit through very different jobs, that you have that connection to London? And he obviously, it was a city he must have really loved, especially if he was flying in the sort of 60s. I mean, unspeakable glamour on Qantas.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
What a dude.
Yeah, he had stories of going to Wimbledon. I think he'd been to Buckingham Palace at some point. He had stories of, now I'm trying to, he would come home from a trip, he took an autograph book with him, one for myself and one for my brother, And if there was anyone vaguely famous on the trip, he'd just get them to sign the autograph book. So I've got an autograph book with messages from, of all people, Dick Emery.
I love Dick Emery.
In fact, he told me an amazing story about Dick Emery. So Dick Emery, you said, was incredibly quiet. Yes. And he was, again, Dick Emery was one of the comedians that I grew up watching with my parents. In fact, my dad in particular was, he had comedy, he had albums from Bill Cosby, Alan Sherman, who did song parodies, Peter Sellers. So I, you know, I really got into comedy because of my dad. But he told me that Dick Emery, incredibly quiet, as a lot of comedians are, you know, out in public. And they kind of said to him, look, would you mind making an announcement as one of your characters? And he was like, oh, no, I couldn't. And they said, "Would you? It would mean a lot if you could. And he was, eventually they talked him into it. Yeah. And he had a very camp character. I think it was Hello Duckies.
Yes.
And so he basically did the entire announcement in flight as that character.
What a good man. It probably really took something from him to do it. Because, you know, when you're not in mode and then you have to, you know... But to do it anyway,
But also when you're not in mode and someone talks you into doing something like that and then you get the laughs and the little laughter monster is suddenly been fed and then you sit down and go, oh, that felt good. Now, do you want to hear about the naughty hypnotist?
Yes, I do. Was it Peter? Remind me, is it Peter?
Peter Powers.
I'm going to actually write it down because I'm obsessed with it. Peter Powers, I'm actually writing it down.
Britain's naughtiest hypnotist. He would do... And look, he was incredibly funny. He was incredibly charismatic, as you would imagine. He would get people to, for instance, get men up on stage and hypnotize them to believe they were going through the worst pains of childbirth ever and they were giving birth to a child. He would convince someone that, or hypnotize someone and tell them that when I wake you up, you're going to see your girlfriend in the audience, you're going to realize she knows you've been cheating on her and you're going to apologize to her in Chinese. And so you'd have some hysterical guy approximating Chinese whilst trying to apologize to his girlfriend who thought the whole thing was hilarious.
Showing that his subconscious is racist.
There'd be an amazing moment every night where he would send two men backstage and my job was to say to them, right, when you go out there, you're going to be the world's best ballerinas. You put on this tutu, you are going to lift. Don't go near the edge of the stage. Don't do anything dangerous, but you're going to absolutely be the best ballerinas in the world. And you'd see these guys looking at me going, yep, okay, sure. And then they would go out and do it every night. And sometimes I'd meet them afterwards and go, oh, hey, that was great. And they'd go, sorry, who are you? I go, I met you backstage. And they go,
Peter Powers would basically prep them. So he'd hypnotize them and then say, and to find out what you're doing, you need to go backstage now. So that they were completely a blank canvas for when you said... This is your task.
Yeah, there's a guy backstage. You will do whatever he says. Yep. It was amazing. It was incredible to watch. It was absolutely fascinating.
It's just, I mean, the stuff these people do is quite traumatizing. I mean, most of the times they say, oh, you know, eat an onion as if it's an apple or, you know, be a smurf. But he's sort of, I mean, what if he hypnotized somebody and made him do that thing who'd actually had an affair? That would really, really rip them to pieces.
Well, there was a thing that he would say to them, say to the audience, even at the beginning of the night, you know, if I do get you up on stage, don't worry, I can't make you do anything that you don't actually want to do. There's no way I can force you to do something against your will. And so that would make people feel comfortable. But I remember having a girlfriend at the time and taking her to watch one of the shows before I started performing with him. And she said, I don't believe in hypnotism. I can't be hypnotized. But he would do a thing at the beginning of every show of, you know, lock your hands together. And then he would do a bit of a countdown. And then he'd say, right, when I count to three, you try and unlock your hands. And maybe 10% of the audience couldn't unlock their hands, which to him meant, great, I can get a suggestion into your head.
Yeah.
And she looked at me, this cynical girlfriend, and went, oh, my God, I can't unlock my hands. I can't. And I was going... But you don't believe in hypnotism. And she went, I know, I literally can't unlock my hands.
Yeah, I had roughly the same thing with the first time I got hypnotized. I was like, nope. And he made me hold my hands up and sort of to lock my fingers apart from my first finger.
Yeah.
And he made me think about them, that, you know, being a screw and then being screwed tight.
Right.
And I had to look at him the whole way through. And he said, right, okay, well, you're not hypnotized any longer, so you can take your hands apart. And I'm just like, make it stop.
Wow.
Anybody with an imagination is susceptible to hypnotism.
Right.
Because you just need to go, okay, I can put myself there. I can imagine there's screws and I can imagine they're tightening. Done.
It's in a similar way to, you know, scam emails always put a few spelling mistakes in there so that they weed out the people that aren't going to fall for it.
Is that why they do it?
Yeah, that's a thing. That's apparently a thing. So when you look at one of those scam emails from a Nigerian prince or whatever, there's always some horrific spelling mistakes in it. And it's because it's so that people like you and I, and I don't mean to talk down about anyone, but so people who would see the spelling mistakes.
Because you know I'm married to a Nigerian prince. Albeit we've not met in the flesh yet. Certainly sent him enough money to make sure that he has safe passage over here.
I apologise. You clearly got
no. The... I mean, this is uncomfortable now, but you're obviously right because I spend all my time going, "How on earth does this scam work? It's so shoddily written."
That's exactly why. It's because people like you then go, "Well, this is a scam. I'm not joining this." And it's the people who don't pick up on the spelling mistakes are the ones that clearly aren't smart enough to even see through this. Like you're basically weeding out the smart people.
I'm trying to think of. Because I remember very clearly when you first came to Edinburgh and you made a big old splash. And at the time, the other notable kind of Australian, albeit very different, was Bob Down, who was doing a lot of... And I remember we used to gig quite a lot with Bob Down. And it was like being on the craziest train. It would just be... You'd randomly be catapulted into a song and dance number that was barely rehearsed. All the time, in this huge wig, he was just bellowing abuse. I remember in doing singing Going to Rio, whatever that song is, with him. And we were just, you know, giving it some... Really trying to help him out, giving it some. And he just looked at the audience and bellowed into the microphone, "Aren't they fucking awful?" And from that moment on, if I didn't love him already, he's cemented in my heart.
There's such a lovely history of Australians at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival too. And I think, you know, I think they paved the way. They made it a lot easier for people like myself. And Bob Down was you know, was going there before me. But even back to, I think maybe 80, possibly 87, there was a tour that was called Oznost, and it was people like Rod Quantock and I think possibly Wendy Harmer.
I don't remember that. And then Leno
and Woodley.
Leno and Woodley.
Yes.
Who won the Fringe and everyone was up in arms and were they Australian, I think.
They were Australian, yes.
And it was a brilliant show. And it was like, you're up in arms because you haven't seen it. It was just beautiful. It was just a wonderful piece of physical comedy that they were doing. I think that was my first exposure to the Australian invasion, as I'm going to call it, Priti Patel style.
Yes, that's kind of, in a weird way, that's what it was called in Australia too. But even before then, before Leno and Woodley, though, there was the Doug Anthony All-Stars.
Yes, fantastic.
And then before them, there was a duo called Los Trios Ring Barkus.
Only by name, though, no, never saw the gigs.
Yeah, so I think they were probably some of the first to come over. So there is a kind of a history of Australian acts, as you say, with Leno and Woodley. And then, you know, recently, I mean, goodness, the doors have opened up for people like Brendan Burns.
Sarah Kendall, Felicity Ward.
Hannah Gadsby.
Hannah Gadsby, the world's, you know, possibly after Stu, I don't even know, maybe even probably the world's most famous comic now. Maybe.
She's right up there. Yeah, yeah. And what's weird is I've been interviewed by a few people who have said, look, you know, what do you think of people like Hannah Gadsby? Are you aware of her? And I'm like, she lived in my flat here in London. I still ride her bike every day.
Do you?
Yeah. I produced Hannah's first ever show at the Melbourne Comedy Festival because we did the Montreal Comedy Festival together and I just saw the way she approached comedy and thought, you are something special. You have I don't really care. Like she doesn't care about fame or fortune or any of that kind of stuff.
No. There's a precision to it. And I just really, and a thesis to everything. And I think, you know, in the way that Stu Lee has a particular thesis that he wants to, you know, he has a way of exploring the world through taking logic to the absolutely most awful and surreal end game.
Yeah.
I think particularly with Nanette, she just made me think about things that I take for granted, like what comedy is. Comedy is randomly generating tension and then expelling it.
Yeah.
It's about resolution and what happens if the comic decides they're not going to make it okay. And then suddenly you realise, God, these people are, you know, they're gods. They can play, as an audience member, they can play with my emotions over the course of an hour.
Yeah.
And it was very, very affecting, you know. And for those who haven't seen it, I thoroughly, you know, run to it. It's available on Netflix. But, you know, to say, I'm not going to make you feel better about my shit life just because we're in comedy. And I cried a lot, I laughed a lot. Went and hugged her afterwards and then realised that probably wasn't a good thing to do. Doesn't really like being hugged, necessarily, by strangers. But it's, yeah. But that's brilliant that, you know, you had such a formative kind of sort of say in the start of things. Well, sure there'll be lots. You'll be like the big granddaddy at some point. And if all more, you know, now you're still young and nubile. But
when do you feel like a granddaddy, do you think? When do you feel venerable?
Oh, you're almost venerable, not in age, but you know, you have a place in the British consciousness,
right?
Yes. And to answer your point about an Australian commenting about British politics, I would say that gives you a unique perspective. You live here, you care, which is the main thing, and you're curious, but also you have that perspective of, actually, I've lived almost as far away from you as it's possible to live. But we share a language and I can see what's happening. And now I'm going to tell you about it. In the same way that Clive James used to be so eloquent about Britain, more eloquent about Britain than most British people, in the same way that Bill Bryson can, or the same way that John Oliver goes to America and tells them. I mean, no one says, how dare you come here, you know, you lime eating. Well, they may do, but I think that sense of... not being, you share sort of, you know, cultural moments, but you're not part of the establishment, makes it better, I think.
Well, definitely. As a comedian, you have to be the person in the corner of the room observing everybody else. And that's a lot easier to do if you're the outsider. Trevor Noah, the same thing for Trevor Noah.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot easier to be not. And anytime a comedian comes to Australia, we love it because they pick up on the stuff that we take for granted and we haven't even realised about ourselves. So, yeah, definitely being an outsider makes a difference. And I think being an Australian, I mean, for me, it was the perfect storm at the Paralympics in 2012, being an Australian talking about disability, because I realised when I read a review, we're just so blunt. Like, English people will dance around an awkward topic, whereas Australians will just go, that guy's missing a bit. And that my natural way is kind of what made me stand out.
And also, I think, exactly as you say, the fact that the Paralympics, but also Last Leg, and the way that you, Alex and Josh, can address disability makes everything easier for people. Because I think for a long time, you know, so I would, for instance, go, I want to ask questions, but I don't want to hurt somebody. I don't want to hurt them, and I don't want to be intrusive, and I don't want my curiosity to make them feel like outsiders. I just want to establish this point of connection because I want to know everything.
Yeah.
And I think Last Leg and the way you and Alex in particular talked about things and laughed about things and could be very brutal and blunt about things, makes life a whole lot easier, because I can just go, what is that? How does that feel? Well, you think that's, look at this. You know?
Yeah.
And I thank you for that, because I know, you know, from friends of mine who have disabilities, that they're being ignored was way worse than dicks like me coming over and going, that's such a cool blade, which now I feel I can do.
Well, there was a moment when we first got together to make The Last Leg, there was a producer called Pete Thomas, and he was the guy who was the kind of brains behind how we make this show. And he and I had had a meeting, and we agreed that we knew people would have questions about disability, and our job was to answer those questions and make them feel okay with them.
Yeah.
But purely because we wanted to showcase the sport. We weren't trying to push any disability awareness, you know, barrow. It was just, well, we want people to see the sport, but we need them to feel comfortable in watching the sport. And so we made a little 10-minute pilot. And again, you know, as is the way of the world, I remember I was in LA. My brother had just got married. I'd gone to LA and I did a spot at a place called the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, which is the best comedy club in Los Angeles, because it's not in Los Angeles. It's 40 minutes south. So it's not, it's real people in the audience, not other actors and comedians. It's where Jay Leno would go every Sunday night to try out his material for The Tonight Show. It's where Ray Romano would try out when he was in LA, Seinfeld, all those guys. Yeah. And I loved that club. I absolutely loved that club. And I did a spot there, and Richard, the owner, said, "Oh, hey, I've got some spots next week if you want to come back and do some more." And I said, "Oh, I can't. I've got to go back to London and film this pilot for a TV show for the Paralympics." And he just looked at me and went, "Oh, you poor thing. You're going to be famous in another country." Because I really was thinking, "Oh God, why do I have to go and do this thing?"
So, as you say, the synergy of the between the show and what was at the time the greatest Paralympic spectacle on earth. There'd never been anything like the Paralympics 2012.
Oh, absolutely! And just the fact that it wasn't on the BBC, who normally do the Olympics, so it didn't feel like an afterthought. It was on Channel 4. And yeah. Jay Hunt had just gone to Channel 4 from the BBC, so she wanted to prove a point by making the Paralympics look amazing. And she had grown up in Australia and seen a show during the 2000 Olympics from a couple of comedians called Roy and HG. And they hosted a late-night wrap-up of the Olympics called The Dream, and they were really irreverent, and they got all the athletes would watch them. And so all of those things came together. She said, "Right, I want to stick it to the BBC. I want Channel 4 to really own this thing. I want a late night kind of anarchic look back at the games." So all of these things came together. But when we filmed that pilot, and I sat with Alex Brooker, because I had met him at the Channel 4 press launch. And again, Pete Thomas, the producer, went, "This guy's great. We need to do more stuff with him." So for the pilot, it was, "Well, how about you just interview Alex as if he's an athlete or whatever?" But while we were sitting in the green room about to go on, Alex, you know, he virtually has the same disability as I do on the right foot, but he also has hands going on as well. And I looked at his prosthetic and we started talking. And then we were talking about, oh, how we both get infected hair follicles. It's a thing that happens inside a prosthetic where it rubs up against the hair on your leg.
Yeah.
And every now and again, you'll get a little, like an ingrown hair that then becomes infected. And because you keep wearing the leg, it keeps pushing up against it. And it just becomes really red and inflamed and pussy. And it's horrible.
Oh, yeah.
And Alex and I were like, "Oh my God, I've never met anyone that's had one of those. How do you deal with it?" And then I went, "Oh, I'll show you what I do." And I took my stump off, and my prosthetic off, and I went, "Right, so what I do is, if you put a Band-Aid over it, it doesn't work because your foot just rubs on the Band-Aid, which rubs on the thing. What you need to do is get a makeup pad, a round makeup remover pad, get your girlfriend's makeup, cut a hole in the middle so it's like a big donut. Put that
like a
donut,
huge corn plaster.
Yes. Put that around the infected follicle and build it up so that the prosthetic rubs on that, but it doesn't actually touch the thing. And Alex was like, "Oh, my God, I had no idea." And Pete Thomas, the producer, was watching it going, "This is the show. This is what we need to film this, because this kind of discussion needs to be on the show." So it was him watching this from a distance going, "Oh my God, this is exactly the type of TV that we need to be making."
And it did two things, because it made, I mean, some of my favorite sports now are Paralympic sports, like wheelchair tennis is one of my, I'm absolutely obsessed with it. But it also asks questions like, what is the B4 category? And hang on, let's really look at how they've broken down the different categories so that the disabilities kind of form a kind of level playing field. And that was always sort of super interesting. But how then you could mock it a bit, or you could big it up when it was needed and then sideswipe it. And then to take that through to the political arena as the show's evolved. To have people who will begin each show by sort of mocking themselves and preparing their sort of outsider status before launching in. It's just the perfect springboard. So I would say venerable status is incoming. But don't for a second think it's gonna you have to wait till the sort of gnarly, well, you've had the big gnarly beard anyway, you've had the granddad look over the But yeah, you know, you have to get used to it. The guy in LA is right, you know? You can be beloved in more than one country.
I think that thing is, as a comedian, you don't ever want to feel too comfortable. You don't ever be sitting on, like, as soon as you feel like I've cracked it, I know how to do comedy, that's when comedy will come around and bite you on the ass.
Yes.
So you always want to be a little bit scared and a little bit kind of on shaky ground in a weird way.
But is there a comedic third act now, or is your dad's words, does that mean that London is your sort of career resting point? Or do you think, you know, having thought earlier on that you might end up in America, does that still remain, you know, in the future as a potential? Would you move again? Would you uproot your life again?
I don't know if I'd uproot, but I would certainly, if I could do something like this where I could commute weirdly between countries. I mean, America still always appeals. There's always a little bit of a...
Yes.
You know, I know from... I think what I do here is a thing that not many people do in America, in that hosting live TV while doing comedy. Like, I, you know, even the late night shows, the Lettermans, I don't think that's something that I would want to do. And they've certainly got their fill of the Trevor Noahs and the John Olivers and Samantha Bee and the people doing the topical comedy. I don't know what the third act is. I'm interested to. I'm certainly open to whatever the third act happens to be. I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up being more documentaries. I made one documentary about joining a physical disability rugby league team in Warrington.
Yes, I remember. It was great.
That I loved, and I loved playing the rugby league, but I also really enjoyed the documentary. So I wouldn't be surprised if I ended up more going down that route, combining comedy and documentary in some way.
Listen, it's all to play for. I've had my hour or so with you, and I'm going to say just a huge thank you. And thanks for just always... It's a hard thing to run a live show. In my youth, I used to do a lot of it, and... To be as gracious as you are on the floor with lots of people screaming in your ear is no mean feat. So thank you for that as well as for this.
Well, there's always been I live by a Johnny Carson quote when it comes to television that I once read about him, which is, it doesn't matter who gets the laugh as long as it's on my show.
That's perfect.
And may I say, crossing paths with you, From I think the first time I met you was in Edinburgh.
Yes, probably.
And I'm going to say it was probably Pleasance One, and I think you were doing a show with Mel at the time.
Yeah, I would have been.
Crossing paths with you has always been a joy. You know what? Your dad is right. You are very good with people.
Well, thank you. I shall take that and try not to cry over it.
Big thanks to Adam, and you can see him with the lovely Josh and Alex on The Last Leg, Fridays at 10 p.m. on Channel 4.
Yes, it's true. When I'm down and I'm blue.